This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There is no such thing as boutique energy. There's no real niche markets for these emerging clean technology products unless we create them with public policy.
The bankruptcy of solar startup Solyndra earlier this year had the clean energy naysayers up in arms, saying that Solyndra's demise proved that governments shouldn't be wasting taxpayer money on businesses that could fail. We all know that startup businesses are inherently risky, and in the clean energy space, they can be quite expensive. But who's better suited to foot the bill and assume the risk, private companies or government-backed efforts? This week on Sea Change Radio, we welcome back to the show Jesse Jenkins, the Director of Energy and Climate Policy at the Breakthrough Institute, a leading progressive public policy think tank. We discuss his white paper titled Bridging the Clean Energy Valleys of Death, which gives an overview of the challenges facing clean energy commercialization and outlines proposals that may allow green technologies and entrepreneurs to better compete with their fossil fuel-based brethren. Guest on Sea Change Radio is Jesse Jenkins, the Director of Energy and Climate Policy at the Breakthrough Institute. Jesse, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me back.
So you just recently published a white paper called Bridging the Clean Energy Valleys of Death. Why don't you summarize what the two clean energy valleys of death are?
So the valleys of death are two key financing pinch points or challenges in the innovation process from laboratory to market that innovative firms and entrepreneurs have to cross. So these are stages where you have to raise a lot more money than you have before to develop your technology further and bring it towards market. And the first one really lies between promising research in the lab and bringing that into commercial product development and developing a business plan and a commercially applicable product around that key research. And the second stage is taking that good idea from prototype all the way up to the full commercial scale that you need to show investors that this thing works, not at a prototype scale, but really at a full, market scale, the scale of a large-scale power plant or the scale of a large manufacturing facility where you can really capture those economies of scale. If you want to earn, if you want to raise, $500 million to build a new factory, you've got to be able to show investors that technology works, and before they want to invest in it. So it's sort of a chicken and egg problem. You got to show that it works in order to get the investment, but you got to get the investment to show that it works. And so this is a real key challenge that we call the commercialization valley of death that traps a lot of companies that really can't make it across that market. They run out of money before they can do it, or they can't find the financing needed to bring their technologies up to scale.
And you talk about how the clean energy space is a high risk endeavor to try to start a new clean energy business for a want to be entrepreneur. But most of the investors that are backing these efforts are low risk firms by nature.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
Yeah. So, I think it's important to differentiate the clean tech sector from a lot of other sectors in which we have sort of become accustomed to lots of startup companies, lots of venture capital backed companies going to market, like information technology or software or biopharmaceuticals. In the energy space, energy is a commodity. We don't really care about electrons or gallons of gasoline. We care about what we can do with them. So similar to steel or copper, these are commodities. And that means that the energy technologies really have to produce energy that can compete on price, rather than features, which is what new technologies in the IT or pharmaceutical space often do. You've got a new drug that can treat a disease better than anything that's come before. You've got a new a new smartphone that has better performance than anything that's come before. Those new technologies in the IT or computing or consumer electronics spaces can claim a price premium when they come into the market. And that allows them to increase the revenues on those initial models and then come to scale scale up their production, improve their products incrementally by reinvesting back into innovation, and then bring the price of those technologies down in price over time. For the energy space, it's a much more of a challenge because you've got to compete on price right away, and that makes it really a fundamentally riskier endeavor, a more challenging environment for new firms to enter into. And the big players in that space, big utility companies or the kind of project development financiers and the big banks that provide equity finance or debt finance for renewable energy or clean energy projects are very risk averse. They're able to give large sums of money out, but are really not able to take on the kinds of risks associated with trying to bring a new technology to market, the way venture capital, for example, is tolerant of risk. So a lot of clean technologies are caught between the scale of capital required, which is only really able to be provided by big financial entities that don't tolerate a risky investment, and the venture capital folks who are able to take bets on risky technologies that could pay off, but really only fund tens of millions of dollars and maybe around $100 million for over a series of financial rounds for a new company. And that's just not enough to take a lot of these technologies to scale. First of a kind manufacturing facility for an advanced vehicle battery or for wind turbines or solar panels may cost you, $500 million to get up and running.
You draw a parallel between the pharmaceutical industry and the clean tech industries, and the R&D is pretty similar, and the time to innovate is around 10 to 15 years in your paper. But you say that the pharmaceutical industries have a higher tolerance for high-risk investments, while these huge companies like Shell or Exxon and other energy companies, these are the most profitable companies in the world, they have a lower tolerance for risk. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so the pharmaceutical industry really is, in a lot of ways, a better example compared to the clean tech sector because of the time scales involved in bringing a new technology to market. I mean, in software, you can give the Facebook guys $1 million and a house in Silicon Valley, and they can come up with Facebook. That's all they need to get running. Developing a pharmaceutical drug takes years, to go through all the trials and iterations that you need to go through, and it can cost upwards of $1 billion to bring a new drug to market. So you are starting to talk about the time scales and the monetary scales that are consistent with the clean tech space. But the big differentiation, and the reason that pharmaceuticals isn't even a very good comparison, is that in the pharma space, you have very strong intellectual property protections around new drugs. So they have monopoly rights over a new drug for the first 10 or so years that they're in the market. But what it effectively does is create a very strong revenue stream for successful drugs. So for investors, the challenge is really it's a risk versus return ratio. And that ratio has to be right. You can take a risky project if the return is potentially really large. And so in the pharma space, the intellectual property and the price premium that you can command for a new designer drug makes the returns on those innovation investments really high. It's also how pharmaceutical firms have to keep innovating in the marketplace because over time the drugs that they have on the market will become generics, and other firms will be able to produce them at a lower cost. And so in order to develop that next iteration of the drug that you can then repatent or to develop wholly new drugs, there are market incentives in the pharmaceutical space for firms to continually innovate. They have to reinvest in new product development or they're going to fall behind.
Or they do what the makers of Prilosec do, which is just change one molecule and have a test against a placebo and show that it still works against a placebo. And so they can repackage Prilosec as Nexium and get another 10 years of their patent extension.
Yeah, well, so sometimes they're able to get away with less significant innovation. Sometimes what they'll have to do is figure out a way to make it a time-release drug that you used to have to take three times a day or something like that. But they have to continually develop new products. That's not the case for the oil and gas guys. You look at an oil and gas company and they have a very profitable product, and what they're interested in is trying to figure out how to get the next barrel of oil out of the ground.
And it starts out as a commodity as opposed to the pharmaceutical industry. Is once it gets to the generic stage, then it's a commodity. At first, it's still a boutique drug until it becomes, it was like if you had boutique energy, but we don't think of it. It's energy. It's just you're plugging it into a wall and the consumer doesn't know if it's coming from a wind turbine or a coal plant.
That's exactly right. There is no such thing as boutique energy. There's no real niche markets for these emerging clean technology products unless we create them with public policy. So in, you know, that there are, you know, some off-grid applications where solar might work better than anything else, but those are really limited markets compared to the scale of the energy market. And so if you want to see these technologies move into the marketplace, that you have to affect that return promise by creating opportunities for niche markets for these technologies, or you have to, and or you have to reduce the risks associated with developing these technologies and bringing them to market. The risk part is the focus of our current report, the Bridging the Clean Energy Valleys of Death report, where we offer four potential policies that could help reduce the risks and close the clean energy valleys of death for entrepreneurs and innovators trying to move their technologies to market. That should help them attract additional revenues. The other side of the coin is, how do you increase the profitability or returns for successful companies that make it all the way to the market? And unless you create early markets for advanced energy technologies so that they have time to improve in price and performance over time and come down in price so they can compete, they'll be effectively locked out of the marketplace from the get-go. And the result is really not a fully competitive energy market. We're effectively going to pick winners. We're going to pick the incumbent fossil fuels and fossil energy providers who won't have to face competition from new market entrants the way you would want in a really vibrant and innovative marketplace.
He that abideth in truth and will have frankincense and myrrh smeared on his gums in abundance, and he shall dwell in the house of the Lord for 6 months with an option to buy. I shall walk through the valley of the shadow of death. In fact, now that I think of it, I shall run through the valley of the shadow of death, because you get out of the valley quicker that way. And he that hath clean hands and a pure heart is okay in my book.
Sometimes it leads up, time to follow. It's time I go where she wants me to go. So maybe today, maybe tomorrow, leaving the woods down below by the road.
This is Alex Wise on ZChange Radio. My guest is the Director of Energy and Climate at the Breakthrough Institute, Jesse Jenkins. His new piece that is on the Breakthrough Institute's website is entitled Bridging the Clean Energy Valleys of Death. When I saw the title Valleys of Death, I thought it might be a play on Silicon Valley and the venture capital firms that have invested in the clean tech industry over the last decade or so. Tell us why you think there is a fundamental shortcoming in that model of venture capital trying to fuel a clean energy tomorrow.
You know, I think that they're the ones who are really good at this and are going to succeed are recognizing that venture capital can't do this alone. I think there was sort of a sense in Silicon Valley, you know, coming out of the dot-com boom that, you know, government doesn't really have a role here. You know, venture capital kind of did it all on its own. It, you know, created all these new, you know, million-dollar companies and made a ton of money. And it was really kind of a hotbed of free market entrepreneurialism and entrepreneurship. There was a rude awakening moving into the energy space for a lot of folks that had that mentality about how pervasive the role of government and policy and regulation is in the clean tech sector, and how much venture capital really needs government's help, how much the private sector and the public sector actually have to partner in creative ways to move advanced energy technologies forward. The venture capital folks that are succeeding and will succeed are the ones who actually remember the real history of Silicon Valley, not in the 90s, but in the 50s and 60s and 70s, when Silicon Valley was really born, and when it, you know, first became a hotbed of innovation and new technology development. And throughout that entire time period, even earlier into the 30s and 40s, Silicon Valley is really built by the Department of Defense and the aerospace, you know, NASA and the aerospace efforts that moved, you know, sort of built first the radio vacuum tube industry here for radio production. And then that led to a number of innovations that ultimately led to the semiconductor industries and transistors.
So let's turn to a couple of the policy responses, the solutions that you set forth in your paper, Bridging the Clean Energy Valleys of Death.
So one of them is actually a program that's already underway. It was first funded in 2009, and actually authorized before that on a bipartisan basis in 2007, and signed into law by President Bush. But it's a program called the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, or ARPA-E. So speaking of DOD, Department of Defense continues to run an Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, now the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that has really been a high-risk, high-reward investor in advanced technologies that would serve military applications. And famously, DARPA funded the initial research and demonstrations that led to the birth of the Internet, which was originally ARPANET. It was a program initiated by ARPA, the Defense Research Projects Agency. They also funded GPS technology, the current drone aircraft that are now an increasingly large part of our military applications. There's been a lot of successful technologies that have come out of the DARPA program. And so in 2007, and actually just before that, a National Academies of Sciences recommended that we need something like that in the energy space, because we need to really see the kind of scale of real dramatic innovations and new breakthrough technologies coming into the energy space as we have historically in the defense application space. And so that led to the creation of ARPA-E, or the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, which has been operating now for several years and has invested in dozens of innovative technologies. Now, they directly address that early stage technological valley of death between really good research and commercial application. So that's one response that's underway. It's really probably underfunded at this point. In the current budget, they're slated to get somewhere between $100 and $180 million, or $180 and in the House side and $250 million on the Senate side. So really not a ton of money when you think about the scale of the energy sector. Or for comparison, DARPA, the Defense Research Agency, gets $3 billion a year. So we're, a whole order of magnitude below the funding level for DARPA. So over time, that ARPA-E program really needs to grow and really needs to continue to play an active role in addressing the technological valley of death. One program that we propose for the later stage valley of death, the commercialization valley of death, when you're really trying to take a technology to full commercial scale and build your first large-scale power plant or your first full-scale manufacturing facility, is a program called that's been vetted in the Senate for a couple of years and has some bipartisan support, and it's called the Clean Energy Deployment Administration, or CEDA. And what CEDA would be is effectively a public bank or a financial entity, much like the Export-Import Bank that we operate now that helps American firms finance export and import deals with overseas markets, or the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which helps develop investment opportunities and markets in overseas in other countries for U.S. firms. It would be a public-run financial entity that would help through a number of financial mechanisms reduce the risks associated with those large-scale investments in first-of-a-kind or innovative technology demonstration. And this program would replace the Loan Programs Office that's come under fire in recent months for investing in the failed Silicon Valley or Fremont-based solar manufacturer Solyndra. So this would really help learn from a lot of the experiences that we've had with the Loan Programs Office and adopt a more flexible and nimble organization that I think can play a much more effective role in addressing that commercialization valley of death.
What countries would you point to as good templates to work from?
That's a good question. There is a green bank that's recently been established in England, although that it's less oriented around specifically around advanced technology commercialization and more around project finance for green for clean energy infrastructure more generally, even stuff that might be a little bit more commercially ready or proven. But that is one example of an innovative model that's using really limited amounts of public resources and then leveraging those to secure additional private sector financing for clean energy projects. In an age of budget austerity, I think figuring out ways to make limited taxpayer dollars go as far as you can in terms of driving and total investment is important. So that's, I think, one example that we could look at as policymakers or analysts here in the United States. I think there are lots of examples in the U.S. history of government playing a key role in demonstrating new technologies, even in the energy space. I mean, look at nuclear power, for example, where the first nuclear reactors were built by directly by the U.S. government with, you know, specialists from the Navy and other departments helping construct the first nuclear reactor at Shippingport. You know, these are complex, you know, large-scale engineering innovations that often don't come to market unless you have a public sector role in demonstrating those technologies. And so I think we can look both abroad and at our own history for examples of public-private partnerships that that pool both public sector resources and private sector investment and expertise to accelerate energy innovation and commercialization. Chats. Spend it all. I have not money. We make it for we see it. You take it. Oh, make me wanna holler the way they do my life. Yeah. Make me wanna holler the way they do my life. This ain't living. This ain't living.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is the Director of Energy and Climate at the Breakthrough Institute, Jesse Jenkins. So a public-private branch like CETA that you're proposing and one that you just mentioned in England, the Green Bank, how would they differ from the current federal clean energy loan program, which is so much maligned from its failed investment in Solyndra?
So I think there's a couple of key lessons to be learned from Solyndra. I mean, one big difference between the Clean Energy Deployment Administration, or CEDA, and the Loan Programs Office that we recommend it replaces, is that the Loan Programs Office really only had one tool, and that was a loan guarantee, which essentially means that we're willing to cover the loss on a loan, on a private sector loan, if the project goes belly up or the company goes belly up. Now that's one way to reduce the risks of investment and attract additional private sector investment. So one of the problems of the Loan Programs Office is that the government takes all the downside risk and really receives none of the upside risk or upside benefits. So that if across the portfolio of companies that received loan guarantees under the DOE's the Department of Energy's Loan Programs Office, if a bunch of those succeed, which it looks like they will, they don't really we don't really share in any of that
short-term
direct benefit. Yeah. Now, obviously, we get new industries and technologies out of it, but we're not able to then reinvest those resources to either cover losses on projects that failed or to reinvest in new projects going forward. And so the other big difference is that CETA would operate like a bank in that it would pool revenues generated by the investments in its portfolio to reinvest back in new revenues. And so it would take a one-time appropriation of funding and be able to kind of recycle that over years. And so you wouldn't really need to fund it on an ongoing basis the way you have to fund a grant program or the Loan Programs Office, for example. Now, the other big thing that I think got the Loan Programs Office in trouble was a confusion, at least in the public, the way it was sold publicly, if not in the way it was operated in actuality, in objectives. You know, a confusion and a mix-up of whether this was a stimulus program that was trying to create jobs today, or whether this was an advanced technology acceleration program that was trying to move new technologies and really help grow entire new industries for the long term. The program was originally conceived as the latter, as a technology program and an innovation program. And it was then funded and expanded under the stimulus, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and then sold, I think, to the public in a lot of ways by the Obama administration and others during that time period as a big job creator. Now, there's a risk of that, because if the inherent goal of something like the Loan Programs Office or the Clean Energy Deployment Administration, or like any venture capital firm, is to invest across a whole portfolio of technologies that some of which are going to fail, You know, some of which are going to succeed and pay off the failures. You know, you have to really balance that whole portfolio. If you know in advance that some of these technologies aren't going to make it, then you don't want to go show up at their factory and say, look at all these jobs that are created. Because if those that factory then closes in the future, as there's a risk that it will, you're going to look pretty silly for having called that a job creator when they lay off all their employees. That's what happened at Solyndra, politically speaking, is that we took a bet on a technology company that didn't pan out. The marketplace for solar changed dramatically over the last couple of years. The price of the raw material, silicon that makes up solar panels, plunged since Solyndra started its path towards commercialization, and low-cost Chinese manufacturers entered the market, and so the price of solar panels fell dramatically, and they just got caught by the changing market conditions, and it didn't work out. So, that was always a risk that some of the technologies invested by the loan programs office were going to fail. And so, getting caught up in a stimulus or job creation mentality or set of public goals, I think it really shot the loan program in the foot going forward. And I think if we create something like a Clean Energy Deployment Administration to fill its place and to learn from those mistakes, we have to be clear that this is not a jobs program in the short term. This is a technology development program for the long term. One of the things that would help insulate CETA is that it would be independent of the Department of Energy and from the Office of Management and Budget in the White House, both of which currently have to sign off on and oversee all of the loans on an individual loan-by-loan basis that are authorized by the Loan Programs Office. So there's White House involvement in the form of Office of Management and Budget. There's Department of Energy involvement in each of those loans. CETA would operate more independently, like the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which is staffed by financial experts and banking experts, and really is judged based on the performance of its overall portfolio, not on any one individual investment. Just like you're not going to judge the performance of a venture capital firm based on one project, you're going to judge it based on the returns on the overall portfolio managed by that venture capital firm. And so CETA would have a degree of independence, would be authorized or would appropriated funding once, so that it wouldn't have to go back to the annual appropriations process every year for new funding. The appropriations process is obviously a time when Congress can respond to those politicized attacks or battles and to dramatically change the course of a program. If CETA doesn't have to go back to annual appropriations every year, then it can operate with a little bit more longevity and a longer term view to what it's trying to do.
Aren't governments even more risk averse than major players in the industry like oil and gas? They don't have to be as risk averse in terms of their balance sheets, but they have to be risk averse in terms of the optics and the politics behind it.
You're right in terms of the optics. One of the things is the way we sell. I mean, we invest $30 billion a year in healthcare research through the National Institutes of Health. That's 60 Solyndras every year, right? In terms of the scale of financing. And we don't have a cure for cancer. Right?
And a lot of those drugs that they develop then
don't
get
go anywhere.
Or they get passed on to pharmaceutical companies after the seeds have been planted.
Right, exactly. After a lot of the initial research and risks have been taken on by taxpayers and by public resources. It's a public-private partnership there to develop new drugs and new. So we see a lot of failures in NIH research, and we see a lot of successes. And nobody is going out there and selling the effort to cure cancer as a surefire thing. But that doesn't mean we're going to shy from the challenge, that we're going to move, that we're going to retrench and not invest in efforts to improve healthcare and medicine in the United States. We've consistently played a similar role in long-term technological development around agricultural productivity and research, around defense applications, around computing and aerospace and communications. And if we don't play a similar role in clean tech, we shouldn't expect different results. We shouldn't expect that we're going to see the emergence of, large-scale new industries in the clean tech sector when it took a government, government's engagement and risk-taking to see that kind of emergence across pretty much every significant technological innovation and new sector in the 20th century, from aerospace and jet engines and to microchips and gas turbines and the list goes on and on. The government has always been a key partner in in advanced technology development, and in this space it has to be as well. The trick is that we have to not sell these things as a surefire way to go. It's not a near-term stimulus program or a job creation program. This is a long-term investment in innovation and technology development the same way NIH is.
Jesse Jenkins, the Director of Energy and Climate at the Breakthrough Institute, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's always great to talk to you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Antibalas Afrobeat Orchestra, Bruce Hornsby, and Marvin Gaye. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.